I found myself returning to over the years. It's Michael Mann's 1995 crime heist epic Heat. And I shouldn't either. There's a few politically correct bum notes in there that really chaff. And then there's the more obvious problem of what to do with Robert De Niro's old movies. Now that in old age he's more well known for being a tedious shitlib. Usually that would poison the well, and it has done on other movies, but I keep going back to Heat again and again. In fact, if I had a load of stats on what movies I say that I like juxtaposed to movies I watch, Heat would probably win. Apocalypse Now is a great movie, but my revealed preferences will reveal that I've watched Rambo 2 many, many more times than Apocalypse Now. Heat covers both these bases. A movie I think is great, but I actually go back and watch time and time again. At first, Heat was seen as a standard crime heist drama, but with the novelty factor of having Al Pacino and Robert De Niro on screen together with each other, trying to out-act each other for the first time. There's also a high-powered supporting cast featuring Val Kilmer, John Voight, Tom Sizemore, Tom Noonan, Natalie Portman and Danny Trejo. And then on top of that, it has what is often claimed to be the best shootout ever put on film. But I have to say, what keeps me going back is the cinematography, the way Michael Mann uses colour and neon lights to express the mood. And the mood is always serious, melancholic and brooding over Los Angeles skyline to sombre synth and blues music. And it's here I think Heat's real depth and meaning is revealed. Why it can survive De Niro's cringe and cartoonish redneck serial killers who murder black girls. Heat is a movie about men, masculinity, and how men have adapted to modernity. And that, in my view, is why so many men have spent so many late nights brooding over Heat the way De Niro's Neil McCauley stares out at the ocean. But before we get into that, let's have a recap of what the actual plot is in Heat, because it isn't entirely an aesthetic experience. De Niro's Neil McCauley heads a small gang of highly capable thieves who won't hesitate to kill if they have to, but prefer to be as professional as possible. They're high IQ and experts in engineering, logistics and construction. Al Pacino's Vincent Hanna, in contrast to McCauley, is loud and vulgar and high energy homicide cop who's charged with taking the gang down. And so what we end up with is a cat and mouse game between cops and robbers playing out across the Los Angeles sprawl. In fact, LA is almost like another character in the movie. And before Heat was made, of course, the same movie by the same director was called LA Takedown. This is something of a reboot. There's a lot of analysis on YouTube about Heat, most often by people discussing the action scenes, also the cinematography and also its themes of loneliness and dislocation from wider society and its norms. And it's here I'd like to get into something of a little digression from the movie. It was earlier in the year when I was reading an obscure book called The Organizational Complex by a writer called Reinhold Martin that Heat came back to my mind once again. Martin's book explores the way corporate America from the 1930s onwards has had a profound influence on how Americans, and by now all of the West, actually live and think, not just in terms of consumerism and working for the corporation, but in aesthetics and architecture, encompassing the very nature of America's suburbia and houses. Beginning with the Rockefeller Building, what became dominant was a modular, cube-like structure or grid, which first became the office block, then whole city designs and road layouts. The same people who designed the office blocks also designed the suburban home and suburbia in general. The driving force behind all of this was efficiency. As Martin writes, quote, modular coordination in its aspect of standardized products and manufacturing processes is inherent in the condition of our time. Two cans of pea soup are more alike than two peas. Units fit into the production process and combine with other units, as interest in the interconnections between modular units keeps pace with the development of the units themselves. The factors common to units become much more than repeated size and shape and are extended to include the unit's capacity for being joined together. there is an increasing tendency toward to produce standard modular units which interlock without the intervention of such aids as nails and glue. Implicit in this development is the search for modules with greatest possibilities. The ideal is a standard module that can be coupled with others in the widest variety of products. Radio sets are made with standardized tubes and components. Buildings are assembled from prefabricated members. Machines have interchangeable parts. Even the screw lost from a doorknob is immediately replaceable at the nearest hardware store. Buildings, bridges, motor cars have endowed the modular relation with vital importance in human thought and activity. End quote. So this is, as others have described, the world of boxes. We live in a box, drive to work in a box, we sit in a box all day, and then we come home and stare at another box until we go to bed. And this has been so extensive that it's created a specific type of man. Martin cites a book written in the 1950s pointing out the type of man being produced by this organisational complex. The book is a critique of the entirely manufactured existence of the so-called organisation man. Quote, "The organisation man was a product of this conformity, the ideal subject of human relations who identified with his corporation as though it were his family." White's figure, the man who wrote the book, had internalised the logic of organisation itself, conformist yet adaptable and resourceful. He does not question the system, but rather seeks out integration at the office or at home, in the new suburbs that hold the alter ego to his corporate family in near perfect symmetry. Here is life in a dynamic equilibrium, an organised procession into the future, in the custody of a social system, its purpose coordinated with that of the larger whole. Though the organisation man remains a lucid critique of the self-regulating processes of the organisational complex, its author, like Reisman, continued to hold out for the redemptive potential of an organic social bond. Even as he urges his readers to fight the organisation and cheat on the personality tests administered by the human's relations juggernaut, his actual target is the dehumanised collective. He sees in what he calls the social ethic of teamwork. The implication remains that the organisation can redeem itself through the restoration of humanity to the integrated system by tolerating a renewed rebellious individualism as counterbalance to the body corporate. White thus fails to recognise the force of his own insights. And so this mechanistic grid-like structure replicates itself throughout all aspects of life and eventually engulfing its own subjects who become nothing more than profit-making machines who are entertained by other adjuncts of the profit-making capitalist superstructure who embed themselves spiritually within the environment created for them. They are a standardised human resource. And so I know what you're thinking. What the hell does any of this have to do with a crime caper with shootouts? Well, in my view, the organisational complex forms the world he takes place in, and the underlining drive of all the main characters is rooted in their different relationships to it and the world that it has constructed. Because the obvious question that has to be asked in relation to the grid-like structure, or matrix if you want, of the organisational complex is, what if you think the life it offers is boring and banal or empty and without meaning? What if you see through the facade and instead go rogue? Atomisation, loneliness and male dislocation have become prominent themes today. But as I've noted before, when the subject of depression comes up in men, the tendency is always to break down the issue to the level of the individual. Take some pills, lift weights, self-improve. Yet what people don't seem to want to confront is the possibility that our way of life is incorrect, inorganic and unhealthy, and depressed and suicidal men are just more in tune with that. But that is a much harder problem to solve than here's some pills. But the problem here is that when we talk about male atomisation and loneliness, we need to be asking, in relation to what? Another route would be some form of political radicalism, which is usually the subject in these circles and a hot topic in society at large. But returning to heat, though, there's also criminality. They're simply outwitting the grid itself and exploiting it, viewing those who dwell happily within it as expendable drones. One of the first lines we hear from Al Pacino in the movie is pointing out that these criminals aren't just gangbangers. They're high grade and know what they're doing. And when you look at De Niro's crew, he is correct. Demographically, they're mainly white. De Niro wears bland grey suits. He's presenting as the organisational man just discussed, as he uses it as camouflage. He's a white man in his 40s. He wants to be the bland everyman, but of course he isn't. In fact, as he explains in the famous cafe scene, he views barbecues and ball games as something to be mocked and scoffed at and looked down on. In fact, he explains exactly what his philosophy is of life. It's to be prepared to walk away from anything or anyone within 30 seconds, flat. His house is barren. There's nothing homely about it at all. He can't settle because if the heat comes on top, he needs to be mobile. No attachments, no baggage. This is pretty much a self-imposed atomization, and he knows it. As he tells Edie, the young woman who's about to complicate his life, he's alone, but not lonely. Edie, though, is lonely. Almost everybody in Heat is dislocated from mainstream society in some way. Al Pacino's situation is the polar opposite of De Niro's. He's on his third wife and lives with her and her teenage daughter in her ex-husband's postmodern art deco bullshit house, as he puts it. And even that relationship is collapsing because he's always out chasing the bad guys and on call 24/7 to deal with all the horrors of Los Angeles' underbelly. What both men have in common is alienation and dislocation in the modern world. And it's when we actually take a look at the world we find once again that everything that happens in this sprawling epic takes place within the modulated grid of Los Angeles. There doesn't seem to be a centre, or a beginning, or an end to Los Angeles, and man seems to shoot it in such a way as to make this even more stark. That said, though, mainly through Pacino's character, we see that the 50s corporate aesthetics of everything being one perfectly integrated system of capitalism and urban living have taken a knock, and the rot and decay are clearly visible. But this adds another layer to the drama. The fact is, these men aren't young. They aren't young crazies full of youthful vigour. They're well into their 40s. De Niro explains to Pacino that he has dreams of drowning, and Pacino tells him that that's symbolic of time running out, and De Niro agrees, he knows. He's still young enough to be physically fit, ruthless. He can still get the job done, whatever it happens to be, but he's against the clock. He doesn't have long. Throughout De Niro's Neil McCauley mentions that he needs just another job or two, then he's out. He tells Edie that Fiji's skyline looks like LA because of the glowing insects it has, the algae on the sea. All of the loneliness and killing will result one day in him living a quiet life somewhere idyllic. You'll see that his worldview is at odds with itself here. Does he want out, or does he not know how to do anything else, as he told Al Pacino in the cafe scene? This dichotomy is going to be the end of him eventually. The centrepiece of Heat is, of course, the bank heist, right in the heart of corporate LA. The gang make it clear to the terrified customers that they aren't interested in their money. It's the banks and the insurance will pay out. They even have the schematics of the bank down to where its alarm systems are based so they can switch them off the night before. In other words, it's an all-out assault on the corporate organisational complex itself. And because the gang have been betrayed by the cringe racist cowboy stereotype Wayne Grew, and more importantly the bond market swindler and crook Van Sant, all hell breaks loose and the robbery descends into a bloodbath. It's possible to dabble into a little Marxist analysis here. Throughout Heat, Pacino seeks out all manner of scumbags and backstabbers, gangbangers and villains in his quest to stop De Niro's crew. But that begs a question of why is De Niro's gang more dangerous than any of the people making deals and spilling the beans to Pacino? It's almost as if the corporate capitalist system elevates direct threats to itself above anything else, that a squad of highly capable white men in their 40s represents such an existential threat that all bets are off and the cops are given a free hand to neutralise the problem. The darkest fears of the system have been realised. The subdued organisational man in his bland grey suit and office demeanour his turn on the system, on the cage itself, the agents of the Matrix turning on the Matrix because it offers them no meaning, nothing life-affirming. Nevertheless, the carnage of the bank heist propels us into the last chapter of the movie, and all of the subplots and character building laid out previously now pay off. It's worth pointing out here that in a standard Hollywood movie, the bank job would have been the climax, but Heat spends almost another hour dealing with its consequences. Pacino's marriage now collapses entirely because his wife cheats on him with the beta everyman dweeb, Ralph.
Maybe I should...
Shut up, Ralph! Shut up!
It's worth pointing out that she's also a dope addict and a bit of a drunk, but the real problem is that Pacino truly belongs to the horrors of the city and not family life. Ralph was chosen to be a stand-in for what she really wants. Ralph is the organisational man incarnate. Again, modernity as depicted here is completely fractured and broken. But Pacino understands that if he really wants to self-actualise, he needs to dump all of the baggage and, in effect, adopt the lonely, monkish life of De Niro's character. The only things he really treasures are his stepdaughter, who tries to commit suicide because of all of the chaos going on, and his television set. And in a symbolic gesture of shedding dead weight, he throws the TV set out onto the street. All he has now is the hunt. The aftermath of the bank heist sees De Niro's character arc take a different direction. He now has a woman and tickets to New Zealand. He seems set to get the happy ever after as soon as all of the loose ends are tied up. There's quite a few loose ends, though. And except on his way to fly free, he makes the fateful decision to go back for Wayne Grow, the scumbag who stabbed his crew in the back. For the first time, he's broken his own code, which dictates that he should walk as soon as the heat comes on top. It's debatable why Mann wrote the script this way. Certainly, he had to wrap it up somehow, and I'm guessing in a film which is already downbeat and melancholic, allowing the main antagonist to fly off into paradise with a sweet babe would have left a sour taste in the audience's mouths. But you can see that De Niro's Macaulay wrestles with the problem. To flee knowing he left behind the piece of shit that was responsible for the death of his friends, and even the rape and murder of his friend's wife, knowing forever that he was out there somewhere. At any rate, he walks away from Edie. The code wins in the end, but it's too late. He now has to walk away from the goal itself, from the life he'd been striving for. Always too late, never enough time. This is, of course, the dream of drowning now manifesting itself in the real world. In fact, after the bank heist, everything De Niro's character does is a frantic race against time. He dies under the flight paths of the planes that should have been taking him to paradise. Pacino has tears in his eyes because he knows that they were spiritual brothers. Not just that they were both adept at killing, at being the best at what they do, but that they were both dislocated, both struggling to find meaning and a place in modernity that made sense. De Niro's character is the more idealist of the two. Paradise is possible, but first comes the killing, the work, the stealing and the loneliness. The chaos of modernity is something to be transcended or endured until it can be escaped from entirely. Pacino's Vincent Hanna is more pragmatic. Yeah, it's all fucked up, but if you have to find a way to live and exist in it somehow. Paradise and the perfect woman probably isn't going to materialise, so you take what you can from the wreckage and make the best of things, though he comes to accept this might not work either. Ultimately, both men can only really find meaning in what they do, but this is precisely what keeps them alienated from normality. The organisational man finds meaning and purpose within the corporate grid and what it provides him with. The atomised man stands outside it, even if only subconsciously feeling that something isn't right. He has to then try and find meaning, knowing that fundamentally something is wrong, something is fake. Do you accept its paradoxes and drudgery, or do you try and exploit it for a loftier life mission? Heat doesn't offer any answers. Instead, it's almost like a form of catharsis, a way for men to process and meditate on the alienation and dysfunction of the present era. It hits us with it on multiple levels. The characters, the cinematography, the melancholic mix of blues and synth in the soundtrack. The final scene is almost like a meta-commentary on watching the movie itself. Like an emotional Pacino, we know if we've witnessed something different, something powerful, but it's difficult to explain why or what exactly. And that's what I wanted to explore in this video essay. So thanks for watching, folks. I'll catch you later.